For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, 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 for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's
right. Welcome to The Clink, Season 5. How amazing this is going to be. First up, guest of Season 5, we have an American man. Someone who was in the US top 15 most wanted. Was charged for LSD supplying, 25 years of which he served 21. Seth Ferrante, welcome to The Clink, Stories of Redemption.
What's up? What's up, man? Glad to be on The Clink.
Mate, I've got to say, what a life you have lived. You know, a young man growing up in a good environment. I believe that you were, you know, are quite a well intelligent young man. That intelligence became something greater than I suppose that you could ever have imagined, couldn't it?
Yeah, I don't know, man. You know, a lot of people, like, I kind of look back now, I think I was kind of naive, you know, in a lot of ways. I mean, when I was young, I mean, I thought I was like smartest dude around, but you know, now as an older man, I kind of look back and, you know, I kind of think I was real naive, but I mean, you know, I was definitely, I would say, you know, smarter, you know, than the average person, but you know, not like I was some Einstein or anything like that. You know what I'm saying?
I noticed that your parents were keen to try and get you to Harvard at one stage.
Yeah, I mean, I come from a like education is really important in my family. Like, you know, everybody in my family pretty much has master's degrees. You know, I eventually got mine in prison, but you know, that's, it was just my mom was an educator. You know, dad in the military. You know, and he was an officer, so it was just something, you know, really important to them. And really, I was on that path until about 13. You know, I was kind of like the all-American boy. You know, I got good grades. You know, I was on a roll. You know, I used to sing in the church choir. You know, I played all the sports. So, you know, up until a certain point, you know, I was kind of that all-American boy and was probably, you know, headed in that direction.
13 is still a young adolescent, but started living the life of an adult, really, didn't you? The party scene kicked in. Seth started to enjoy a different way of life.
Yeah, I think... At 13, that's kind of when I discovered marijuana. And, you know, marijuana has always kind of been my drug of choice. You know, I tried other drugs, but, you know, I always came back to marijuana. That was kind of my thing. And I just remember when the first time I smoked it, you know, it just kind of, I don't know, like it filled a hole in me, you know, like it balanced me out. It just kind of made me feel, you know, I guess normal to a certain extent. And, yeah, and once I got that feeling, you know, I kind of fell in love with it, and you know, it's probably a bit of escapism, you know, escape whatever pressures, you know, I had on myself or I put on myself or, you know, whatever you want to say, society put on yourself or whatever, but you know, it was also a little bit of romanticism, you know, I kind of you know, romanticize like that outlaw. You know, I've always been the type of person, you know, I like gangster movies, you know, I like you know, I like Bonnie and Clyde, you know, I like Billy the Kid, Jesse James, you know, I like that outlaw, whatever it is about, you know, outlaws and gangsters, I mean, that's what I like. So I was attracted to that from a real young age, and I think for me, getting into drugs, it kind of made me feel, you know, like I was kind of, you know, on that outlaw stage, you know, and I kind of romanticized it a lot, you know, like I was that counterculture rebel or whatever.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. I grew up in a very similar sort of way and mindset. For me, it was the streets and, you know, gang life in the streets, which then led me to, you know, involved in a lot of sort of drug activity. And I used to see the value in the dollar rather than the needle in the arm, so to speak. And it was just the way it was back then. We had an epidemic of the gear or heroin. I think you guys were the crack era. We didn't really have that here. But for you, it was the good old cannabis, pot, marijuana, whatever you want to fucking call it. And then the LSD.
You know, I got into the weed scene first, you know, as a real young kid. You know, I started smoking and you know, just like how you were talking about, I found out real quick, you know, that if I had the balls, you know, or if I had the know-how to go score, you know, I could score for everybody else and I could get free drugs.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I started dealing drugs. You know, I think everybody at a young age, you know, you kind of go through that because, you know, especially when you're 13, 14, 15, it's not like you got a lot of ready cash available. You know, it's not like, you know, you're working a job or your parents aren't really giving you that much money. So I found out really early. I was like, you know, if I knew who to score from, you know, if I could go get it, if I could, like, you know, make sure we didn't get ripped off, you know, people would just kind of give me all their money and then I could smoke for free. And this went on, you know, real early, like, you know, 13, 14, like into like ninth grade, which is like your first year in high school over here. And just being in that scene, kind of the weed culture, you know, the counterculture, I started getting in, you know, to other, like what I call, like I call them the righteous drugs, you know, like psychedelics and
Yeah.
weed. To me, those are the righteous drugs because, you know, if you're getting into cocaine, heroin, you know, methamphetamine, stuff like that, it tends to be, you know, you deal with more like, you know, drug addicts, people fiending, and, you know, violence can come into it, you know, when
Yeah.
people don't pay their debts. You know, the weed and psychedelics, especially in the suburbs in America, I mean, it was a kinder, gentler, you know, drug scene. You know, a lot of people, I mean, you know, everybody's gonna rip you off every now and then, but, you know, people weren't carrying guns. It wasn't you know, as you know, high strung as dealing, you know, with drug addicts who are, you know, going out trying to rip off stuff to pay their dealer.
It's
You know,
funny,
so it was kind of.
we talk about, you know, that whole sort of scene, and I guess if we put it in perspective, you know, it was just that real cool, cruisy scene. Like the people you're dealing with, like you say, there's no high sort of strung energy or no high addiction in reference to people sort of hanging out and wanting to take your head off because they can't score or, you know, it's a totally different scene. You know, we see movies, I guess, and for our listeners out there, you know, you watch those American, and I say American, and Australia's, we've got shit going down here at the moment. Actually, it's pretty full on. But, you know, America's always held that, you know, that Mexican border sort of scene where you're shipping, you know, tons of cocaine or cannabis across in tunnels, and then it comes over, and then you guys in the States are just pumping it out. Like, it's fucking real. It actually is real. This shit happens. It's not just made on movies for the sake of telling a story, is it?
Yeah, no, I was actually, you know, because if we're talking the 80s, so, you know, I started doing all this stuff in the mid 80s. And in the mid 80s, they had some homegrown cannabis, you know, but at first, like the early 80s, I mean, the homegrown cannabis wasn't really that good. You know, it wasn't until like the end of the 80s where they started getting the stuff from the Emerald Triangle, like Humboldt County, Mendocino County from Northern California, that it's really started getting good. When you got homegrown in the early 80s, usually it was like shake. And, you know, it was like, you know, like big buds. It just wasn't, you know, that good pot. But we used to get all like the brick pot. Like the brick pot was crazy. I mean, it was all coming from Mexico. And they would ship it in these big bales. You know, I remember the first time I got 10 pounds of Mexican brick pot, probably when I was about 15.
Was it all
And
that
the
big
whole.
brown, like brown Buddha sort of look? That brown.
No, it was, I mean, they had brown, but you could get like, you know, good green bud, but it was all pressed. So look, I got a 10-pound brick that was maybe like about this big and
Wow.
about this wide. You know,
Wow.
so it was almost like about the size like of a skateboard. You know, maybe a little thicker though, but you know, about the size of like a kind of rectangle. And that was like it was like 10 pounds. It weighed 10 pounds. And what we used to do is I used to get the weed like that, and I would get like a 10-pound brick, and we would take it, we would put it in the microwave, right? We would break it up and kind of put it in a bowl, and we put it in the microwave, and we would cook it. Not for long. You don't want to burn it. You know, we would just cook it. We're trying to break it up so it'll break up easier, so we
So it
get a
just
little bit
fluffs up.
hot. Yeah, because what they do when they grow the weed down there, what they were doing, because they wouldn't cure it. You know, like if you grow marijuana, like you grow it, you're supposed to cut it down.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to let it dry. You let it dry for a week, and then you put it like in a mason jar, and you let it cure for about 2 or 3 weeks. That's how you get like the really nice bud. What the Mexicans were doing, they were just like cutting it down and you know, put it in like a compactor and pressing it like you press hay.
So in other
You know,
words,
so it'd be an easy.
completely full of resin.
Yeah, but it also, you know, because you never let it dry, so it would have like that ammonia smell. You know, so you would get these weed in these big slabs or these bricks, you know, and like I say, I started out getting like 10-pound bricks, and then you know, I worked my way up where I was getting like, you know, 50, 60, 75, 100-pound bricks, you know, 3 or 4 years down the line. But you would get these bricks, and like I say, I would put in the microwave, I would break it up, you know, I would kind of fluff it up so it looks better in a bag. But also what I would do after I took it out, I would get like a bunch of oranges or a bunch of lemons and limes, and I would chop them all up. And then I would take all the oranges and lemons and limes, and I would throw the, you know, 10 pounds of weed that I just blow up, I would throw it in a hefty bag. And I would put, you know, like a bag of orange, a bag of lemons, and a bag of limes, and throw all those in there, all chopped up. And then I would let it sit. I would let it sit for like 5 days. Because what it would do, that weed, it would absorb, you know, the fruit, and it would absorb the smell, and it would get rid of that ammonia smell. So that was like my thing. I kind of became known. You know, it's crazy because I was like branding cannabis, you know, like in the mid-80s, you know, and I was just doing it because it was, you know, for sales, you know, because people, you know, I was trying to make it different than what everybody else had, you know, the brick ammonia smelling pot. So my bud kind of became known as like they used to call it the Tutti Frutti
Tutti
bud.
frutti, yeah, right.
And also, you know, I started like around that age, like 16, 17, I started getting weed from California, like good outdoor, you know, because in the early 80s, outdoor was kind of garbage, but then by the mid to late 80s, it started getting better. So I would actually get weed sent from like the Emerald Triangle from Humboldt County. So when I would have that good weed, I was trying to almost match it with the brick pot, you know, because the good weed you can only get in the fall, like in harvest time, like when in September, like when they harvest it. And then the good weed might, that good outdoor might only be around till like December, January, and then it's gone. It's all gone. They sold it all, you know, because most of the farmers up there, they're only getting maybe like 25, 30 pounds. You know, that's how much they're getting off. They're doing the national forest.
What was the place in California? It's before they become legalized with the marijuana over there that they had like some serious underground growers growing there. It
Yeah,
was
no,
a
that's Humboldt. That's
That
Emerald
is
Triangle,
where
man.
people go missing.
It's like northern Cali. It's like way northern California. It's like
Bear country,
about,
isn't it?
you know, they had a show, Murder Mountain on Netflix
Murder
called
Mountain. That's the
Murder
one I'm
Mountain.
thinking about. You got me. That's thank you. Thank you. I
Murder
reckon
Mountain.
there'd be still
So,
fucking barrels of cash up there stashed somewhere. The people wouldn't have
yeah, maybe,
there'd
man.
be some
Maybe, I don't
serious
know.
holes up there, eh?
And then they just had this other show on Hulu called Sasquatch. What it was about Northern California. I mean, it was about Sasquatch, but it was set. You know, they keep having these, you know, docu-series that are set up there, but they're not really about the weed culture. They're like about something else. Like Murder Mountain was more about like the murders, you know, and they were trying to find this one person that got killed. And then the Sasquatch is like this weird Sasquatch. They said some Sasquatch killed these marijuana guys. But I'm actually correcting that because this summer I'm going out there in July from July 20th to July 27th. I'm gonna start filming my Emerald Triangle cannabis documentary.
I've got a good buddy that's just come back to Australia. I won't say his name, but I don't know if you're familiar with Cypress Hill. They're in business with a product called Elite Garden over that way. And
Yeah, no, I love Cypress Hill. I love Cypress Hill.
so I think it's Be Real from Cypress
Yeah, be
Hill.
real.
He's in
Yep.
business with my buddy who's just come back now, and they've got one of the biggest farms or production, legalized production farms
Oh yeah,
over
Dr.
there in
Green Thumb.
Elite
That's what
Garden.
they call it, Dr. Green Thumb.
Dr. Green Thumb, that's it. That's the
Yeah,
one.
that's what he calls his weed stuff. Hey, look, here goes another aside. You know, I'm kind of like a cannabis influencer, right? So, like
Woo!
all the
Makes two of us,
people,
brother.
you know, whatever. But you know, I didn't never thought I would be an influencer, but I'm kind of like a cannabis influencer. So all the people, like, they send me stuff, you know, and they want me to post about it and do little videos and stuff like that. So I think it's because I used to write for Vice a lot. I don't really write for Vice anymore, but I had like a 5 years where I wrote for Vice. So I think everybody hopes I can get them advice. But I always tell them, I'm like, I don't write for Vice anymore. But Actually, Dr. Green Thumb, one of the publicists for that brand, Dr. Green Thumb, Be Real's brand,
Yep.
they sent me like this big hookah. You know, it was like the kind
Oh,
that
the
they
one that spins
flip.
upside down.
Yeah,
How good's
yeah,
that?
yeah.
I can't get one here. I want someone to send me one.
Yeah. So look, they sent me one of those, and then they sent me like about $1,000 worth of stuff, man. Because that big hookah is like 500,
It's
you know. And then
crazy.
they sent me like a little vaporizer, you know, for dabs. And then they
Yep.
sent me like a little portable vaporizer. And then they sent me like another vaporizer that I could put in the hookah, you
Oh,
know, like
you.
an electric one.
I look, I was never a smoker. For me, when I was younger, my downfall was the rack, or what we call the rack cocaine. So that was just the scene and what I ended up, as drug of choice. But I had a severe injury going back a few years ago now that nearly cost me my life and being able to walk. And I was on opioids, and somebody said to me, "Look, you got to get off them. They're going to fuck your life. You get on this." And this was a CBD product back then. Still wasn't refined to what it is now. But ever since then, I use CBD every day, and I use my flower every night. And I am a pharmaceutically medicated, approved
Yeah.
user here in Australia, which is, we're slowly, I guess, catching up to you guys. You guys have got an amazing, positive scene around cannabis, hemp, marijuana, whatever
Yeah.
people want to use the
No,
name of.
it's been spreading. It's been spreading. Actually, that I'm in a medical program here. I live in Missouri, which is like
Okay.
right in the middle of the United States. Like they call it the Midwest. Like say, I live in St. Louis. They've got a medical program here that I've been involved in 2 years. And I was actually growing. I was growing for almost 2 years. Just recently, I gave up my grow because I just become so busy with my film stuff that, you know, I didn't have time, you know, because I was putting like 2, 3 hours in the garden in the morning, 2, 3 hours at night.
Are
I
you
mean,
allowed
anybody, you know.
allowed to grow there though, because you're pharmaceutically approved? Can you grow your
Yeah,
own?
no, yeah, they call it medical marijuana. Yeah,
Oh
so it's a
wow.
medical,
So we've still got
yeah,
to
the
pay. The
medical
government is
marijuana.
we've still got to
Yeah,
pay, like,
no.
it's like 200 and say 200 Australian dollars per 10 grams.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah,
Yeah,
they're
over
making a
here.
killing. They're making a killing on us. Like it really is. It's got to change. But and the laws still are, they'll lock you up for a plant. It's
Yeah.
kind of
No,
crazy.
I was legally growing 54 plants.
Wow.
I was a caretaker for 3 patients, you know, being me, my wife, and her sister. So I could grow 54 plants.
It's kind of funny that you're able to relax and sit back and talk about it now, but you at the age of 19 were wanted top 15 in the States. You were looking at 25 years for a non-violent crime, a first offense of supplying LSD. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, my case kind of came about, you know, like I said, around, you know, 13, 14, 15, I started getting involved. I started selling to friends. And then eventually, like 16, 17, you know, I started getting bigger amounts. You know, when I got some money, actually how I kind of got my first large sum of money, you know, that I used to start making bigger purchases is I had a baseball card collection, you know, from when I was a kid. You know, I was a fanatic about baseball cards. You know, baseball was like my favorite sport when I was a little kid. So I actually collected, you know, baseball cards from the age of like 5 to like 15. So I had like this massive collection. And I used to go to all like the baseball card conventions, the baseball shows, and trade and buy and speculate, you know, on who was going to be good, like when they came in as rookies. And I made a lot of good bets, you know, and I had a lot of cards of people that, you know, turned out to have real good
Sure.
careers. And so I went and I sold it, and I got like you know, like 13,000 for this baseball card collection,
Wow.
you know. And then and then when I did,
That's a
I
lot of
started, I
cash
used
back then,
that.
Seth. That's a lot of coin, man.
Yeah.
That's a good start.
Yeah, so I took that, and that's how, you know, I started buying that brick pot. But you know, that brick pot was pretty cheap because I was getting that brick pot for probably like 350, 400 a pound, you know, at
Wow.
first. And then, like I say, I would do that whole thing, break it up, making it in the Tutti Frutti bud, and then I would basically sell it for like, you know, 40, 45 a quarter. So, you know, I was getting like 160, you know, to 170, 170, 80 an ounce. So I was making over $1,000 a pound. I got, you know, I figured out really quick, you know, probably by, you know, the age of like 16, 17, you know, that if, you know, I could travel, you know, go down to Dallas or go down to Florida, like Fort Myers, and I could get this brick pot really cheap, and I could bring it back up to Northern Virginia, and I could sell it for a lot, you know. And also, you know, in the harvest, like in the fall, I would get the stuff from California sent to me through the mail, but it was always limited how much I could get. It would always be real good bud, but you know, I mean, if I could get 5 pounds, I was lucky,
Yeah.
you know. But then I met some people in Kentucky. And what a lot of people don't know is there's two like outlaw weed spots in the United States that are known for weed, Northern California and Southern Kentucky, right? So I got hit to this, you know, and I was like in Northern Virginia, which is like that's like not even like 7, 8 hours from Kentucky. So I started driving down there in the fall and I started getting good bud too. They got a lot of clay in the soil, so they would have this bud that, like, the way it would come out with the clay, you know, it'd just be like these really nice, you know, kind of, you know, fruity, citrusy type bud. And I started bringing this up, and so, you know, I was kind of rolling, and I was doing the LSD thing too. You know, I was getting the LSD sent from California, and
So
you know, I would come up with some mushrooms.
when you were getting it sent, was this in sheets? You were already sort of getting them dropped and dried and all that sort of stuff,
Yeah,
or were you
yeah,
getting
yeah.
the...
I would get the blotter paper. Yeah,
Wow.
I wouldn't get the crystal. I would get the blotter paper. Sometimes I might get lick the liquid, and if I got the liquid, you know, the liquid, I would you know, just get like a you know, like an eye drop or something, and we would put, you know, put it on like a sugar cube.
Yep. Oh, wow.
The stuff I was getting, all the prints were MC Escher. You know, like MC Escher is like this badass, like kind of futurist, you know, artist that has like all this crazy stuff. And you would get the sheets, you know, and it'd be like a regular, almost like an 8x11, you know, page,
Yeah.
you know, like a regular writing paper. And it would have 10 sheets, 10 little sheets. So, you know, it'd be like, you know, a thousand hits on one page. On the page, you could see all the artwork. It'd be like they just took the print out of a book
Yeah.
and it would be on the blotter paper. And then you'd take the individual sheets off with 100 hits, you know, and you could only see part of it. But it'd be cool because first I was just getting, you know, a couple sheets, you know, then I'd get like a page, but then eventually I got what they would call a book, and a book was
Yeah,
like 10
that,
pages.
yeah, 10
So that was
thousand.
like, you know, that was like 10,000.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, this was all like a progression, like over the years, you know, I didn't like jump into this. I just kind of built up, you know, I got better contacts. You know, I got hooked up with different people because I was always the type of dude too. I just had a mind for business. I was always like, whenever you're doing something, you know, whatever type of business, I mean, it could be drugs, it could be whatever, but you know, you want to get your capital up and then you want to get as close to the source as possible so you can get the cheapest price. So that's what I was always after. And I don't know what it is about me. I was just always lucky because, you know, the people above me, you know, the people, the connections or the source, they were just like always like me, you know, because I was like this young kid and I was coming and they would say like, look at this kid, man, like he's about his business. He's come with like 10 grand cash, you know, and they would even like clown like some of their friends, like some of the older dudes, you know, because they'd be like some of the older dudes, they'd be like, man, this kid comes with 10 grand cash
Yeah,
and you
what are you
can't
doing
even
hitting
come
me
with
up for
five.
tick?
Yeah, they're like you want me to front you stuff, and they're like this kid, you know. So eventually, how my business grew is I went to this really big high school in Northern Virginia called Robinson, and it was like 4,000 kids. And then we had like this sister high school that wasn't even like 5 miles away called Lake Braddock, and they had like 4,000 kids. So, you know, by my sophomore, junior year, you know, that's like the second, third year of high school, you know, I'm like 16, 15, 16, 17. I'm selling basically like retail amounts to anybody. Like I don't care if somebody wants a hit of acid, you know, or eighth of pot, I would sell it to them. You know, if somebody wanted like five sheets, you know, and a quarter pound of bud, I would sell it to them. You know, even if, you know, I had some people that maybe they wanted a pound. So I just sold to everybody. And then, you know, around 88, all these people that I was doing business with, they started going off to colleges.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I graduated high school 89. So, you know, like 88, that's like when a lot of the people that I was dealing with, like the kids like a year or two older than me, they started going off to colleges. And when they started going off to colleges, you know, they would call me up and they would be like, yo, man, they'd be like, man, it's dry up here. We can't get any good bud. We can't get any good trips.
So
They'll be like,
this
man,
is
can
all over the East Coast of America.
you? Yeah, all over, you know.
Wow.
So they would just call, you know, because I was in Northern Virginia. you know, but I had friends going to Penn State in Pennsylvania. You know, I had friends going to West Virginia University in West Virginia. I just had like my friends went to all these different colleges, and they would just call me and they'd be like, man, you know, come hang out, come party and bring some drugs, you know, bring some shit up there. They're like, you know, not only for themselves, but they're like, we want some for us, but we could sell some too. We got, there's a lot of people here. They want drugs. I mean, because basically, I mean, anybody that doesn't know it, I mean, I don't know about the universities over there, but I'm sure it's probably the same. But the colleges over here, dude, is just like, dude, you can take like 10 pounds of weed and you can sell it in a weekend.
Well, you see all the movies and, you know, all the frat parties and all this sort of stuff and all the carry on over there. And I don't think we have as much fun here in our universities. I think they try. But I think we get a lot of expats from over there that come over here trying to bring that way of, you know, doing uni over there and create it here. But I'm not sure it's the same as what you guys had locked down over there. I think that's a different ball game altogether. I mean, it looks like a good time.
Yeah, no, it's just, I mean, college is known as just like a party time. It's like a time to go, you know, you get your degree, but you go party for 4 years. That's what everybody, you know, because it's kind of like everybody's 18, they move out of their parents' house for the first time, and they just go crazy, you know, and most of the area was I was from, you know, it's mostly like, you know, middle class, you know, upper middle class, and you know, I mean, they got, you know, not like they're rich or anything, but they got money. Their parents are giving them money, you know, and they're paying from the college, and you know, they're paying for their school. Some of them, you might even get some money like scholarships and stuff like that, you know, academic scholarships or whatever. So, yeah, it was crazy, man. So I started going to all these colleges, and then by the time I was 19, you know, I was basically supplying like 15 colleges in 5 states. You know, because it was, you know, because like if you're into the drug business, it was like too much traffic. So eventually, like, I would just pick certain friends I would have. You know, I would be like, okay, boom. I'd be like, boom, this dude is in this fraternity at West Virginia. I'm like, when I come to West Virginia University, I'm running everything through you. You know, so I just kind of, so everybody, even dudes I know, there might be some dudes I knew longer than them, but I would just pick whoever I thought was like the smartest kid that had the most respect. And you know somebody too that you know like have a fraternity brothers behind them, so you know if any you know bullshit happened or whatever, so they would have somebody that had their back. But yeah, man, I just started going, and I got to where I was doing the acid. I was basically doing like you know like 100 sheets, like 10,000 hits a month. You know, like every month I was getting like 100 sheets of acid. You know, I was getting like what they call a book, you know, 10 pages, and I was moving like I dropped like. You know, it's weird too because like the different colleges, like they had a college like Virginia Tech, and Virginia Tech is kind of known as like an engineering school, you know, like a lot of smart kids. And Virginia Tech, dude, I can move like 30 sheets of acid a month at Virginia Tech.
30
You know?
sheets, they're 1,000 a sheet.
Yeah.
Far out. Wow.
No, that's like yeah. So, I mean, that's
That's
like
crazy.
basically,
It's
you know what I'm
huge.
saying? Yeah, I would move that every month, but that's like all the brainiacs, you
That's
know
what
what
I
I'm
mean. Do you
saying?
think that's what made them all so creative?
I don't know. It was just weird, but it's like those the smarter colleges with like
Wasn't
all the
Picasso on
engineers.
acid?
Yeah, they love that shit, man. They loved it.
Bring
It
out
was
that
I was like Virginia Tech.
creativity.
Yeah, Virginia Tech was like my biggest market for LSD. Not as
Wow.
big for weed, you know. Not as they didn't want as much weed. They wanted the acid. They were all tripping.
With this at such a young age, Seth, I mean, look, I mean, I'm only speaking from what I see on the outside looking in. You must have had some feel of empowerment knowing that you were this guy that was able to create and make this happen and see this value coming back in constantly, you know? Like, I mean, it's almost like you know, you've created your own sort of underworld network through what you were doing.
Yeah, I mean, for real, I was a little arrogant prick, man. You know, for real. You know, looking back now, I mean, looking back now, really, I was pretty lucky, because I mean, I was pretty blatant, but I was pretty. I'm not saying lucky. I mean, I eventually got busted, so not lucky in that regard. But I was pretty lucky, you know, like that somebody didn't come in and rob me, you know, because I didn't carry guns,
Well, that's the
you know,
thing
or
too.
nothing
You're a
like
young
that.
guy making some big coin. Like you're a target for anybody that really wanted to, you know, you're up there at that age and in that era, that amount of money. Man, you're doing well.
Yeah. No, see, you know, I met dudes like later in prison. You know, like I met dudes that used to rob drug dealers and stuff like that, and they told me straight up. They were like, "Look, man, no offense, but
we would have took
man,
you.
If I would have known you, I would have got you
100%."
Yeah, but my whole thing was right. I knew this, and I knew that I didn't carry a gun. So my whole thing was like, I was the type of dude like, let's say I'm coming to your spot. You're my guy at West Virginia University, right? And you know they didn't have cell phones back then, so I got like a 1-800 beeper. That's how I do all my communication. I got like the nationwide beeper.
Yeah.
And so let's say I'm going there, so you're beeping me, and then I'm stopping at payphones, and I got like I basically carry like jars of fucking quarters right around with me in my car because I get on the payphones. So I'm getting on the payphones and I'm calling you up, and you're like, "Yo, man, you were like, when are you gonna be here, man? I got everybody's looking for something, man. You know, and to throw people off." You know, I might tell you, I'd be like, "Oh man, I'm down here right now, man. I'm going to be up there in 3 days."
Yeah.
But really, I'm 2 hours away.
Yep.
See, because I know the money's there. I know the money. As soon as I get there, I know the money's going to come to me. So I don't got to plan nothing. But that's what I would kind of. That was kind of like my protection. You know, I would not let dudes know where I was. You know, nobody knew where I was. I would just show up like randomly. You know, and I would use a lot of misdirection, and I would lie to people on purpose.
I think Seth, even in like, I mean, look, life's different today, and I'm sure it is for you, obviously, and for myself. But I still won't tell you where I am from fucking 1 minute to the next. Yeah. I'll plant that I was here, that I haven't been there for hours, but you'll think I'm there. It's a way I think look at life.
No, I got friends like outlaw friends that did time, right? Mm. And they do stuff like that, right? Yeah. They do like, these are dudes I know really, really good, and they do stuff like, you'll see them like they'll post stuff like they're at the beach or they're, you know, skiing or something or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I'll call them up, I'll be like, "Dude, I saw the shit you posted on social media." And they were like, "Oh no, I'm at home, man. I did that shit 2 weeks ago. I'm just posting it now."
How good's that?
Yeah, like they post everything delayed, you know, because they don't want people, you know. And I would say, I don't know, sometimes I'll do that to a certain extent, but not like I did back then, you know, because now, you know, now that's kind of faded. Like I'm more into the entertainment stuff, so kind of that whole criminal mentality, you know. But I mean, it's still a part of me, you know. I still, what I don't like, and I go through this with my wife all the time, you know, who loved my wife. My wife did 21 years with me. Waited for me for 21 years.
Yeah, mine stuck with me for 17 and 14. Like I've not 21, but I respect what you're saying 100%.
Yeah, because I always tell people like my wife's like one in a billion, right? But
two in a billion got.
That's what I'm saying. You don't find women that wait like that, man. No. You don't. I mean, most of them are gone. But like she we go through it all the time because I always tell her like she like any wife. You know, she wants to ask you a bunch of questions and know everything you're doing. And I always tell her, I'm like, stop monitoring me. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, you know, so it's, you know, but we go, it's a little battle we have, you know, but she doesn't mean, you know, not like she's looking to set me up or anything.
No, I hear that. Yeah. I hear that very loud and clear. What was the turning point for you when you come undone? Because it went from you doing this wonderful sort of East Coast run of just success at that time, I guess. To all of a sudden your ass was grass, man, and they were coming.
Well, what happened is, there was this big field party. It was like in the summer of 1991. And actually when this happened, I was actually in Hawaii, you know, cause I was the type of dude too. Like sometimes like after like I did a load, I would just like, you know, disappear for like 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, I would do my load. I would go hard for like 5 or 6 months and then I would just like fuck off.
Kick back.
Right. Yeah. So I was actually the spring of 91. Like I went to Hawaii. I went to Hawaii for 3 months, you know, like May, June, July. And while I was gone in June, though, I had a couple dudes, like a couple of my buddies from like Radford's and Virginia Tech. They were back in Northern Virginia. So I was sleeping. I was getting them sent acid from California because this time, too, this is like. A lot of times, like in the summer, sometimes you wouldn't even be able to get brick pot, you know?
Yeah, because of the growth patterns in the season.
Yeah, how the bus came down is in June, I kind of, even though I wasn't there, I was in Hawaii, I kind of flooded the area with LSD because all the guys that sold LSD for me, they were all back in Northern Virginia. You know, they weren't at the colleges. And I was sending them all LSD, but they were all trying to sell it in Northern Virginia. They didn't have the college markets. So the whole area got saturated with LSD, like in the summer of 1991. And like this is how saturated it got. Like usually hits of acid sold for $5,
Wow,
right? And I, yeah,
$5.
$5, yeah, $5 a hit right back then.
So what were
But
they
look,
costing
I
you, like
flooded.
50 cents each for a sheet?
Oh, I was paying like basically like 25, 30 cents a hit.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like I would get like, 10,000 hits for about, 2,500, 3 grand sent to me.
Wow.
So look, it was selling for like five a hit. And I saturated, because all my guys were back in the same area because they're all from Northern Virginia. So I'm and everybody's cranking up for the harvest. Everybody wants to build up their cash flow for the harvest, to get the good weed in
Yep.
September, because good weed was what you can make a lot of money on.
Okay.
You can make like $1,000 a pound easy. So the area is flooded. And this is like I say, like, I was a smart kid in some ways, but in other ways, I was really, incredibly naive, because this didn't even occur to me, what I was doing. So I was sending so much acid back there to guys that it saturated the market. Like a hit went from like $5 to like where you could only sell a hit for like $2. I mean, that's how much acid. And there was no weed, so it was just like all acid.
That's
So everybody
huge.
was tripping, right? And they used to have these big
Literally,
trip parties. Yeah.
everybody was tripping. That's an understatement, isn't it?
Yeah. So
Wow.
they would have these big trip parties, right? And at one of these big trip parties, it was out in this area called Clifton. And Clifton is like it's basically an area where, like the houses, they're like 5 or 6 acre lots, and they're like big $1 million houses, like even back then in the late 80s, early 90s, these big $1 million houses. They're probably worth like who knows how much today, probably
Yeah.
like go for like 8 or 10 million. But so and whenever in the States, like what people do, like whenever people's parents go out of town, the kids stay there. They just throw big parties in the fucking houses. That's like the fucking thing, especially like in the summer. Whenever the parents go, it's like, oh, your parents are going to throw a big party.
Yeah.
So these one, group of kids threw this big party. These are college age kids, but probably like 19, 20. And but they let all the high school kids, everybody came, and we're having this big field party, and they had like they had like a band playing, and then they brought like some like skate ramps,
Oh,
some
yeah.
dudes were like skateboarding all around and stuff
Yep.
like that, and some BM bikes and doing stuff like that. But the bands were playing and they were like really loud, so the neighbors called the cops.
Yeah.
And the cops came to this big field party, the parents aren't there. So they start breaking up the party, making most of the time they don't arrest nobody. They just make everybody leave. They're like, okay, it's over. Party's over. Everybody go home. And that's usually what the cops do. But there was this one kid that was tripping on LSD, like a young kid. He was like probably like 15 or 16, and he was having a bad trip on LSD. And when he saw the cops, he started freaking out. And he was like running around naked. So the cops saw this young kid running around naked, and looking like he's, blasted out on fucking drugs. So they start chasing him through the woods, right? And the cop tackles the kid, and somehow the kid grabs the cop's service revolver and shoots him in the arm.
Oh,
You
wow.
know what I'm saying? So
Yeah.
he grabbed the cops, and so then like they bust this kid, they take him in, and that's how my whole case started. Because one of their own, and how that is with cops or
Yeah,
law
yeah.
enforcement when
No one's
something,
letting go of that.
So even though he just got shot, even though it was an arm, it was a pretty, it wasn't like a flesh wound, it was a pretty bad wound, So
Was that
they
something?
started having.
Is that something, Seth, that obviously, you wouldn't have been too aware of where you were in Hawaii at the time, I'm sure, but you all of a sudden would have become very aware of what was happening?
Yeah, no, I did. I heard about it. I heard
Oh, so
about
you
that,
were
right?
aware of what had taken.
Yeah,
Yeah, righto,
they
okay.
told me. Yeah, 'cause look. So then, because I mean, I was aware because it was in my network. So
Yep.
the kid bought the acid from somebody in my network, but he was like seven people removed from me. But still, remember I told you earlier how like the bigger I got, I started insulating myself more and picking, who I would give the drugs to.
Yes.
But this dude who actually sold the kid acid, like this was a dude that I used to sell to in high school. Like I knew him real good. I used to party with him all the time. Like when we were like 15 and 16, we were like really, really good friends. you know, now this is 3 or 4 years later, you know, I've insulated him from myself. I don't sell him drugs directly, but he's still, you know, getting drugs from my network. And I didn't really hang out with him anymore because, you know, he was kind of like, you know, when I was real young, I was more like a metalhead dude. You know, I was like into metal, you know, but then the older I got, you know, I kind of got like, you know, because I was selling a lot of drugs. So I kind of adapted more like a preppy, you know, kind of a preppy image, you know, because I didn't want to walk around with like long hair.
The long
like
hair. Yeah, yeah. As you can see in photos of you before.
Cops.
Yeah,
yeah. That attracts cops. So I kind of moved away from that scene and that look. And I became like a little preppy kid, like all the little rich kids, so I could blend in. And so this dude, his name was Dave, you know, the kid that shot the cop, you know, he tells him, I got the Astra from Dave. So that's like, you know, they go to Dave, and then, you know, Dave says who, you know, tells him about me and says who he got the acid from. And that starts like the dominoes falling, you know, and they basically have like a witch hunt, you know, because it was like Fairfax County, you know, which was a county I was in. So it was just like the Fairfax County cops. But, you know, when the cop got shot, you know, then they called in the DEA.
So
and
it's
also
all federal.
Like another. Yeah. Another weird thing that happened in my case is like, you know, this is like 91. So they started these laws like around 88, 89. Like they, you know, they call them like the war on drugs, you know. Reagan kind of started that in the mid 80s, but then around 88, 89, they made like these real harsh laws over here, you know, called like the federal sentencing guidelines and mandatory minimums.
So when you speak of this, I instantly refer back to something that you have a massive part of, and that's White Boy, which is a documentary on Netflix. And predominantly that's where you're talking about a lot of this, eh?
Yeah, because the same thing basically happened to him, you know, the war on drugs. So when they passed all these laws, right, at first, you know, they're just going after the you know, it's real racialized. They're just going after the black guys. They're going after the black dudes in the inner city, because that was like when the crack era that you mentioned earlier, like the crack era was like running rampant, you know, it was like an epidemic. Like they had like, you know, young black kids in the city. You know, young black kids in the city, like they were like murdering cops and shooting cops. And this was also the time like when the Pablo Escobar stuff in Colombia was going on. And, you know, he was like a narco terrorist.
Huge.
And he was trying to take over Colombia. So, you know, and I always look, I try to look at things like all sides, you know, whatever. I mean, I got fucked with the time I had to do. But, you know, I try to look like why shit happened. You know, I just don't get angry and blame somebody or say this or that or like I hate these motherfuckers. You know, I try to be real analytical how I look at stuff. So, you know, I could see that the government was scared, man, because, you know, you got the Pablo Escobar stuff happening. You got all the young African-Americans. It's like the Wild West. They're shooting cops. They don't give a fuck.
So this was all about, you know, crack distribution, power, money, and that's it. Who could be the best and the most feared on the streets and make the most amount of money in that era?
Yeah, the crack era was about some gangster stuff. And, you know, it's also funny because when I was in prison, I started writing about all this stuff, but you know, that's in the future in the story too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah. So all this stuff is happening. Then like 91 comes, right? And so 91, when my case happens, this is about 3 years into all these new laws, because they got passed. So for 3 years, they're just basically like cracking all these young African-American kids in the head and giving them like life, 20, 30 years. So, you know, for crack. And for a small amount of crack, you know, like you would get the same sentence for like 5 grams of crack that you would for like 50 kilos.
Wow.
You know, yeah, it was like 100-to-1 ratio. It was like totally, you know, like racial injustice, you know, but, you know, that's a big thing in our country too, you know, all the racism and stuff. But what happened like around by 91, you know, like a lot of the politicians, like the African-American politicians, they started saying like, you know, like, wait, what the fuck? You guys are just, you know, all the African-American youth, you're like, just send them to prison forever. Like, you know, lock them under the jail, bury them under the jail, you know, lock them up, throw away the key, you know? And so they were, you know, even back then they were kind of saying, wait, these laws are about race. You know, these laws aren't about justice. So then what do the feds do? You know, the feds do, you know, and rightly so they were saying that, because, you know, in retrospect, you're looking back now, the laws were racist.
Yeah, yeah, but, no, 100%.
what the feds do to kind of, you know, make themselves look good, you know, they were like, oh, no, we bust white drug dealers too. So that was when they started. They started like the first wave, like going out into the suburbs and getting like the weed guys and the psychedelic guys like me. So I actually got caught. You know, they were actually like searching.
So they had created this web basically, and just started getting people stuck to the web.
Yeah, man. So they were actually like looking for white drug dealers out in the suburbs, you know, to kind of say like, oh no, we get white drug dealers too. So it just so happens, you know, like, I'm the type of dude, like I'm either the right place in the right time or the wrong place at the right time. You know, there's like no middle ground for me.
Yeah,
because I've had a lot of points in my life where I'm like blessed. Yeah. I've really been in the right place at the right time, met the right people, but you know, it's two extremes, you know, so I get both extremes, you know, so I've also been like the dude, you know, that gets fucked, that's been at the fucking wrong place at the wrong time,
yeah,
you know, wrong place. So this happened to me in 91 when my case came about, and, you know, they had like basically like LSD witch hunt, and then, you know, they just went and they threatened all my friends. And these are all like, you know, middle class, upper middle class white kids, you know, from good families, you know, going to college, you know, either in college or going to college. And the feds came in, you know, the DEA and the FBI and the, you know, the prosecutor's office, the U.S. attorneys, and they just came in and they just started threatening people like, boom, you know, tell us where this came from. Or, you know, eventually they found out me, you know, tell us about Seth or you're going to jail for 10 to life. And, you know, I can say for the probably, you know, the first 5 years of my bid and even back then, you know, I was all like the outlaw dude. And I was like, oh, these fucking snitches, fucking rats. You know, even my first 5 years I was in prison, I was like really, really angry, you know, that all these dudes betrayed me. But, you know, now, you know, as an older man, you know, with 30 years, you know, looking back now.
But what would you have expected from that sort of caliber of person? This is not their world. Yeah. They're not gangsters. They're not out there trying to be the fucking Dom Perignon of the drug industry. This is, like you said, this is young people, well-to-do families. You throw it. You know yourself, when you see people in jail, they come in, you know, you get 12 months for a guy, that's a tough time. And, you know, when you're in there doing double figures, you see the real side of people, you know, and, you know, to tell someone that's never seen that side of a life and hang on, you are going to go tend to life. Their asshole starts going like this.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And then the way the cops do over here, man, like they threaten, they're saying, especially like the one young white kids, they're like, oh, we're going to put you in the cell with Big Bubba and he's going to rape you. And they like say stuff like that to people. I mean, they're like evil motherfuckers, man. A lot of these law enforcement people, not all of them. It's like anything. There's some good dudes and bad dudes, but they use that, you know, but, now, I mean, in retrospect, looking back, I mean, I don't blame the people for what they did, you know, that snitched on me or ratted on me. I blame the system. I blame the people that run the system. I blame the people that set up the laws. Yeah. You know, because I'm the type of dude, I try to see the bigger picture, you know, like, whatever, this dude snitched on me. But, you know, like you said, he really didn't have much of a choice, man. He wasn't cut like that. He wasn't built for it. And really, the way they come at people, it's really evil when you think about it, man, because, I mean, like in this country, you know, with the war on drug stitch stuff, you know, they try to get like, you know, mothers to snitch on their son or vice versa, or sons to snitch on their fathers, or brothers to snitch on brothers, or cousins to snitch on cousins. It's like really evil when you think about it, how they do that shit, man.
It's actually traumatic.
Really evil.
Very traumatic. And the way that they go about mentally destroying somebody who's never had to be confronted with any sort of challenge like that, you're a different mindset of person if that's the life that you live. You know, there's a code that you live by. There's a way that we live. It's just... it's a different style of human. You know, you throw someone, it's like I was watching a small documentary the other week, and it just so happened to be about the new age, you know, the gangs, and how that in America, they'll give a gun to someone wanting them to be a soldier, and next minute they'll send them out on the street without any education, without any knowledge of what could come or how you should and shouldn't do or do this. They're not machines. They're not this particular person that's coming through that wants to be a part of that crew. He's not there. He might have been a good people person, which he could have made money, but he's not a shooter. So don't hand him the gun and get him to go do the shooting, because at the end of the day, when he does snitch and roll, could you expect anything less?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's a little bit of logic, isn't it?
Yeah, you shouldn't. You shouldn't. That's what I've done a lot of thinking. Like, I'm like, I shouldn't have put those people in that position in the first place. But, you know, also, like I said before, I was a little arrogant prick, and I thought I would never get caught. I thought I was too smart to get caught. You know, I knew about the conspiracy laws. You know, even at that age, I knew about the conspiracy laws, the federal conspiracy laws. Yeah. But I would tell people, like, when I was with my friends, I would say, and I would kind of say it offhandly or almost as a joke, but I would say, look, this conversation didn't happen. You know, if there's like three of us, because if three of us know this, it's a conspiracy. So I would like make little jokes, you know, like, hey, we're not even having this conversation, but, you know,
Was the Vlad laws coming in at that era, the end of that era, around that time at all over there?
Oh, what, for the, for what laws?
For the Vlad laws, for organized crime and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's, I got a RICO Act charge. I got a CCE.
That's what I'm referring to. Yeah.
I got a continual criminal enterprise. So what my charge is, it's saying that I had five or more people that worked for me and took direction from me.
So you're the mafia now, man. You're the mafia.
Yeah. No, but it's some bullshit because it's like, dude, I was basically like, I was like a freelancer who just had good connections. And I had a lot of people that, you know, sold drugs for me. And, you know, most of them, I did front. I fronted out a lot of stuff. You know what I'm saying? Not like I had a lot of cash buyers. A lot of stuff was front because I would go through a college and I would drop something with a dude and he would owe me like whatever, 10 or 20 grand. And then I would come back in a couple weeks and pick it up. That's how I did business.
Yeah,
I would just, you know, roll from place to place. But, you know, they painted me out like I was this big kingpin. Like I was setting the market price. I was telling people. You know, like they said, like this dude was my lieutenant, this dude my lieutenant. But I mean, that was all bullshit because what the feds do in this country, it's like every new case is public enemy number one. So every new case, you know, it's like the bigger headlines. They're like the bigger villain, you know, and they just trying to make it, you know, because the way the criminal justice system is set up in this country is the way that prosecutors, you know, get promoted or go to better jobs is by having cases, you know, that are in the news. And I'm going to give you a perfect example. If you heard this name, Rudy Giuliani, who's now like, you know, whatever, senator or mayor or something. He was a prosecutor that prosecuted John Gotti.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that's how the prosecutors, that's how they advance in their career by having these big cases. So every, you know, in this country, it's not about justice. It's about winning or losing. Even like, check this out. One of the guys on my case, there was this dude. He was the assistant federal prosecutor. You know, like the second guy in charge in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Northern Virginia. His name was Henry Hudson, right? So I took off. I fled. You know, I faked my suicide and all that.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because I think that's a massive, massive conversation to have.
Yeah, I'll go into that right after this.
Sure.
But look, so this guy, Henry Hudson, so he starts out, he's assistant United States prosecutor. You know, I flee. They don't get me. My case is like a black mark on them. You know what I'm saying? Because I'm supposedly the leader of this big conspiracy and I'm just gone and I don't get my punishment. So he goes from the U.S. Attorney's Office to the U.S. Marshal's Office. And he becomes a head U.S. Marshal in my district, like the Eastern District of Virginia. He does the paperwork to make me most wanted because, you know, it's all retribution. I'm like the one that got away. All right. Now I find out after I've been in jail, like 10, 12 years, like this dude, now he's like a federal appeal court judge in the Fourth Circuit.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying?
Who the fuck's going to get an appeal against him?
Well, that's what I'm saying. But he's a dude. Cause look, so what they do is like I'm not saying for a teenager, I mean, I was a big drug dealer for a teenager. You know, I was making like 20, 25, 30 grand a month.
Yeah.
You know, not generating. I was making 20, 25, 30 grand a month. You know, I was generating, you know, sometimes like 50, 60, 70, maybe 100 grand a month, you know. Mm. But this dude, you know, when he made me I was like a black mark on his record because I took off. Then he became U.S. Marshal. He made me top 15 most wanted. They caught me. That's like a feather in his cap.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and then he used all that to catapult, you know, not just my case, other cases like that, too. But he used that to catapult himself to a federal judgeship, and he used that to catapult himself to an appeals court judge. And the appeals court, federal appeals court judges in this country are some of the most powerful people.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
definitely.
Because the only thing after them is the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, that just goes to show how justice and criminal justice works in this country. But
and I think that too, Seth, it's something that we aren't really privy to. I mean, look, our system here is, you know, a bit different. As far as I'm concerned, you're guilty till proven innocent. You know what I mean? Here in Australia, you're over there, you're innocent till proven guilty. But the moment you're charged here, you're convicted. Do you know what I mean?
No, it's the same. It's the same thing here. They say that, dude. Look,
it's bullshit.
And like I say, I'm you know, I can speak critically about America because I'm an American, and there's a lot of advantages to this country, you know, but there's a lot of disadvantages. But you are, like, once you're processed, once you're in the system, basically it's the same, like you said, you're guilty until proven innocent. And if you don't have money,
you got no
chance. It's harder to prove your innocence.
Yeah.
You know, if you got money, you can find them. Because look, dude, like, my case was the United States of America versus Seth Ferranti.
That's huge.
So, United States of America, they have all the resources of the whole fucking United States versus me.
Yeah.
You know, when I was like fucking 20.
How did you feel knowing that? I mean, we'll go back in a second to the disappearance, the attempted suicide note and all the rest of it. I think that was pretty awesome the way you went around that. Didn't work out the way you wanted it to due to a miscalculation, I believe, of wrong side of the river. But anyway, I'll let you tell that story. But, you know, knowing that you were going in facing life, basically, I mean, 25 years. See, in Australia, it used to be 10 years is what we called a brick. 10 years was life. And then they changed it to life and sentencing life. So life is life. And, you know, 15, 20, you're doing life. That's a big whack. How were you mentally sort of starting to deal with this, knowing that you'd never committed a crime, especially a non-violent crime at that? And here you are, a young man that's facing the country. The country is against you.
Yeah, no, it was kind of, it was devastating. You know, at the time you kind of think about like, okay, whatever, you know, I'm cut for this, you know, whatever. You try to like, oh, this ain't nothing, you know, but really, you know, I mean, that shit was devastating because basically I was faced with three options, right? You know, I could go to trial. And everybody knows, you know, you don't want to go to trial against the feds in this country because they got like something. They got like a 90, they got like, it's like a 98% conviction rate.
Yeah.
You know, and if you go to trial against them, they slam you even harder, right?
That's right.
So, you know, I could do that. You know, I could plead guilty, you know, and take whatever they give me. Like they were offering me like 20 to life. You know, I could have cooperated, you know, and maybe got a reduced sentence, like, you know, 5 to 10 years or something like that. You know, that's something I didn't want to do. So those were basically like the three choices that were offered to me by my lawyers, like once I got busted. And to me, like, I always equate it to, you know, because like I say, I was a little arrogant dude. You know, I thought I had the world by the balls. And, you know, then like the feds come in and they just like wipe my whole world out. They just, you know, whatever I had, they took, you know, they got, you know, they got a bunch of sheets of acid, you know, they got some weed, they got some money. So they just take everything. And I always think about it. It's like that, that Jimi Hendrix song, right? Jimi Hendrix, he has a song, it's called like, and it has a lyric. It goes like, you know, castles made of sand slip into the sea eventually.
Yeah, that's true.
You know? Yeah. And I used to love that song. That was like one of my favorite songs. So I felt like that's what happened to me because it's like I had this little empire that I built and then the feds took it from me. And then like I was like nothing, you know, I was like nothing because everything that I had built up, like my whole self-image, it was all based on being like this counterculture outlaw, you know, drug dealer, you know, psychedelics, weed guy, you know, the righteous guy, selling the righteous drugs for a good price, you know. And everything was built on this. So then when they took it away from me, I was like a shell.
Yeah.
You know, and then I was like a shell of myself, you know, because I was like where all my self-esteem was, you know. So I was like, fuck, man.
Well, your purpose, wasn't it? The whole purpose is gone.
Yeah. Yeah. So then, you know, and then I'm faced with these choices. You know, I can go to trial. You know, I can plead guilty, look at 20 to life, or, you know, I can cooperate and maybe get, they were telling, my lawyers telling me like 5 to 10 years. So, you know, I'm looking at these options and I was like, fuck. I was like, man, I don't like any of these fucking options.
Yeah.
I go, all these options are some fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
Right. I'm like this. And you know, that's because I was thinking like, man, I'm like a first time nonviolent offender. You know, I never, you know, I wasn't a violent dude. You know, I used to use my mind, you know, to get around people or to get around obstacles. You know, I didn't use my fists. I didn't use violence. I've always been the type of dude, I use my mind. You know what I'm saying? And usually I can get around obstacles. I can avoid people, you know, and I can work myself around people, you know, because there's always, you know, a million different angles you can do something.
Sure.
So, you know, so I was like, fuck, man. I was like, this is fucking unbelievable. And then, you know, I was like, too, I was like, shit. This is supposed to be like America, you know, land of the free, home of the brave. I was like, what the fuck are they trying to do to me? Like, I'm fucking, you know, like I'm some fucking, you know, Pablo Escobar, or John Gotti of the suburbs. I was like, this shit is fucking crazy, man. So
King of the kids.
Yeah. So I started thinking and I was like, man, you know, and I remembered, right. I was like, man, I just got to get the fuck away. Cause I still had a little bit of money, you know, that they didn't find. So, you know, not a lot, but I had a little bit of money and I was like, you know what? I'm like, I just want to fuck off. I just want to get out of here. So then my main thing, like I start thinking, my brain starts like, you know, cranking like.
Were you by this stage already charged and bailed? Was this, or was it just that they were coming?
No. I was charged. I was arrested right. And I got bailed because see, this was too, really, I'm probably one of the people that fucked it up for the people after me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because, you know, at that time, you know, like they looked, you know, where I was from and who my parents were and what my background was. And they didn't think I was going to flee.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So they gave me bail. You know, they're like, oh, you know, this kid, he's a good American kid. And like I say, at the same time, like, you know, they were trying to get me to cooperate, you know, because of the feds, like everybody, almost everybody, you know, everybody plays that gangster shit. But most of the motherfuckers cooperate, you know, especially when they're facing fucking 20 to life.
Yeah, everyone's a fighter until you get punched in the head.
Yeah, so that's what they think. They think like I'm a fucking, you know, good fucking upstanding, you know, from a good family. So they think I'm going to cooperate, right? So, but they didn't know, you know, they didn't know that I was really a fucking, you know, I was scheming. I was a fucking outlaw. I was scheming like, how the fuck can I get out of this the whole time, right? So, yeah, I was on bail, and so I'm thinking, I'm like, how the fuck? I want to take off, but not only do I want to take off, like, I want to throw them off my trail.
Yeah.
You know, I want to make, like, these charges go away. I want, like, Seth Ferrante to, like, disappear, you know? I want to become somebody else, right? So I remembered, you know, being in that area, you know, I was always a big sports dude. So, you know, back then it was, like, newspapers. So every day I would get the newspaper and I would go right to the sports section because I was a sports fanatic, you know, from a young age. You know, I played sports. I loved sports, you know, at different ages, sometimes baseball, football, basketball, soccer. Every time I would get the Washington Post and I would go to the sports section, the section in front was the Metro, you know, kind of told what was going on.
Okay.
And sometimes I would get struck by like the headline on the Metro. And I remember they would say like, you know, so-and-so, whoever, commit suicide at Great Falls by jumping in the water.
Yeah.
So over the years, I'd seen this headline probably, you know, half a dozen, a dozen times. You know, so this, you know, this stuck in my mind. And then when I was thinking, like, I need to leave, I need to disappear, you know, I need to make it so Seth Ferrante doesn't exist. You know, I started formulating this plan, you know, and the plan was basically, I'm going to fake my suicide.
In part two of my chat with LSD kingpin Seth Ferrante, Seth faking his own death, his stint in jail, and more of his story of redemption as a movie maker and author. That's next week on The Clink.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
That's right.
For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you.
That's right.
For the record, lab on me going all the way.
All the way.
For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste.
Stop calling.
For the record. For the record, for the record, for the record, for the record, for the record.